Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, after months of wrangling in the House of Representatives, it appears that bills dealing with aid to Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and some humanitarian packages for Gaza and other places will eventually get to the floor of the House of Representatives for a vote this coming weekend. Now, beyond the headlines of all the drama inside the House, there's actually some leadership lessons underneath that are worth thinking about. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, yesterday, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson formally unveiled the foreign aid bills. This was a little different approach than what had been taken up. The Senate, of course, had one single bill dealing with different aid packages for Ukraine, Israel, the Indo-Pacific, and other national security priorities, along with some humanitarian aid specifically targeted for Gaza. The Speaker unveiled those, each of them to stand alone and to be open for an amendment process. And so that is where things are moving along. It appears, and everything I'm hearing coming out of Washington, D.C., is pointing to Saturday as the day that those will actually get to the floor. And then the real fireworks, I think, will begin then. In the meantime, of course, the other drama is unfolding with Marjorie Taylor Greene and a few others becoming a little more vocal in their willingness to exercise this ability to vacate the chair, which is basically a fancy term for saying removing the Speaker of the House. And it's one that has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of threats, a lot of back and forth, a lot of drama, a lot of social media posts, a lot of national cable news appearances, and a whole lot of fundraising emails to boot. And it's interesting to me when you get past all of those headlines and all of that chatter and clamor and drama, there's actually some interesting things going on underneath. I think there was a moment yesterday when Speaker of the House Mike Johnson actually became the Speaker of the House. As he unveiled his plan for these foreign aid bills to reporter, he was asked point blank about the effort by Marjorie Taylor Greene, Representative Massey from Kentucky, and others who have been rattling some sabers, that they would exercise that ability to vacate the chair over what he is putting forward when it comes to aid, these aid packages. I want you to listen really close to his response.
My philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel. I believe Xi and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live fire exercise for me, as it is so many American families. And I'm going to allow an opportunity for every single member of the House to vote their conscience and their will on this. And I think that's the way this institution is supposed to work. And I'm willing to take personal risk for that because we have to do the right thing and history will judge us.
So many lessons in there. To me, that's what a Speaker of the House should sound like. That regardless of what the criticism is, regardless of the threat, are you willing to do what you believe is the right thing? Now, we can have debate and we'll get into all of the details in terms of what these proposals do and don't do, where they should be in terms of priority with other domestic issues that many are calling for, including border security and immigration reform. Those are all the policy debates beyond that. But the thing that I think was most important about what the Speaker of the House said yesterday was that he said, to me, this is something that I have to do as the Speaker. That's what leadership does, that every member will have an opportunity to vote their conscience and vote what they believe is in the best interest of the country and for their constituents back home. That is how it's supposed to work. And he said, if I lose my job over that, then so be it. In other words, that's functioning from a position of strength. You've heard me on this program many times. Ask people running for office, ask the candidates, What is it that would make this worth it, even if it cost you your job? What's the one thing you would do, even if it guaranteed that you would be out of the job you're currently in? Because if a candidate or an elected official can't answer that question, I question whether or not they should be in the job. Because if there's not something that they are so passionate about or so committed to do for their constituents or for the American people or our constitutional republic that they would give up their job to do it, they haven't thought hard enough about what the job actually is. Because the job is not about re-election. The job is not about some consulting gig or lobbying job when they're done. It's not about writing a book and having a memoir or becoming a talking head on cable news. And so, again, set your feelings about Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan. You can set all that aside for a second. Just from a leadership standpoint, what the Speaker of the House said yesterday is exactly what I would hope we would hear from all our members of Congress. That let's put things on the floor. Let's have debate in front of the American people. Let's vote on amendments to make the bill better or decide what we need and don't need within it. And then let's vote on it. That's the way it's supposed to work. And the Speaker of the House said history will judge us accordingly. And I think he's absolutely right. Now, I also want you to listen to the House Democratic leadership, the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries. He talked about his belief in the path forward and why it does matter that Speaker Johnson bring this to the floor. Take a listen.
Our top line commitment is ironclad. We are going to make sure that we stand by our Democratic allies in Ukraine, in Israel, in the Indo-Pacific, and make sure that we secure the humanitarian assistance necessary to surge into Gaza and other theaters of war throughout the globe.
All right. So here's an awesome day when I can say I 100% agree with the minority leader from the Democrats, Hakeem Jeffries, and I 100% agree with the Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. In those two bits of sound that you just heard from those two leaders, they were actually leading. It was not the politics. It wasn't the posturing. It wasn't playing for 2024 and who's going to win in November and all of those things. That's what it's supposed to be like. That's what it's supposed to sound like. And I actually loved that Representative Hakeem Jeffries used an and rather than a either or. He avoided the fake fight and the false choice. He said, we're going to do these three things and we're going to take care of some humanitarian needs in Gaza and other places around the world. It's an and conversation, not a this or that, not a fake fight and a false choice. And so I think the fact that these two leaders were actually leading yesterday, that's a good day. That's a good day. And I'm sure that on Saturday, when these bills get brought to the floor, there'll be some ferocious debates. And there might even be some theatrics and some fireworks before then, as some members of the Republicans try to vacate the chair and remove Speaker Johnson. And I think that the Democrats and Hakeem Jeffries just might say, not so fast. We actually think we can work with this person, and they may keep him in that speaker's chair with the speaker's gavel. So that's what it's supposed to sound like, folks. And we should expect that not just on a day like today, where, as the speaker said, history will judge us in the end. But as voters, we should expect that every day from our elected officials. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Well, Iran spent years increasing its influence in the Middle East. Also, the use of proxy paramilitary groups such as Hamas and Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen. And now as things get more intense with a strike against Israel over the weekend, and now the world waits to see what the Israeli response will be, we want to get into the question is, what is the U.S. strategy in relationship to Iran? We often say that hope is very important, but hope is not a strategy. And sometimes it appears that the administration is grasping maybe a little more at hope than it is strategy when it comes to Iran. Someone who's taken a deep dive on this, Nihal Tusi, Politico's senior foreign affairs correspondent, has a great piece on the strategy. And Nihal, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So give us kind of your perspective in terms of where is the administration, where is President Biden in terms of strategy, or are we just kind of hoping?
Well, the Biden administration does not have an Iran strategy. That's kind of the bottom line for me after talking to a bunch of people and covering this stuff for years and following Iran in particular. And, you know, that's kind of what it comes down to. Now, you know, some people will, you know, quibble over what counts as a strategy. But the way I see it is that if you have a strategy, it needs to solve a problem. And if you consider Iran a problem, as they do, you need to have a strategy to try to solve that problem, whether it's its behavior or one aspect of it, such as its nuclear program or something. And they don't really have anything right now. They just don't. It's more about, you know, it's long been about keeping it off the president's desk the last several months. That's been much harder. But it's been mostly about just kind of containing things, keeping it as low boil as possible, managing the problem instead of solving it.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important perspective to dig into. And you do this beautifully in the piece, talking about the difference between tactics and strategy. And you can actually go back to The Art of War. The Art of War says strategy without tactics is the slowest path to victory. But tactics without a strategy is just the noise before defeat. And you used words like containment and de-escalation and deterrence, kind of that tactical stuff. Is there any semblance in there in terms of a strategy, or what is the conversation moving toward as things do escalate in the Middle East?
Well, I think, you know, at the moment, the immediate focus is trying to limit this conflagration between Iran and Israel, right? So there's not a lot of energy into longer term strategy about Iran, which is at, in many ways, the kind of the root of so much of the destabilization across the Middle East, according to the Biden administration itself. But one way that they are approaching it is kind of a backward approach, which is they do have a strategy called regional integration, right? So this is where they want to get the Israelis and the Saudis to become friends and hopefully create a pathway for a Palestinian state. As part of that, they want to build economic security and other types of relationships between Israel and Arab countries, at least some of them in the Middle East. And the idea being that because many of these Arab countries also dislike Iran, just like Israel does, that maybe if they unite with Israel, you'll have this united front that will put pressure on Tehran and the Islamist regime there. And so it's sort of this idea that maybe over time this will weaken the regime there. The problem with that is that the Middle East is a very complicated place and every single country has its own interests. The Saudis, even as they have been talking to the Israelis about getting something going, they've also been trying to mend fences with Iran, right? And there's other countries that are not willing to come on board with Israel. And now the war in Gaza has made that even more complicated. So the administration, you know, bottom line is it really does not know what to do when it comes to Iran itself. And, you know, there is the argument that if you can, I don't know, it's a hard problem, though, right? I want to give them some credit. This is a really hard problem.
Yeah, the degree of difficulty factor is very high. So we will grant the administration that for sure. The interesting thing to me is not just in the Middle East, but in other places, it seems that the administration has really taken this approach to a lot of areas around the world as sort of the de-escalate almost at, not at any cost, but almost. And it seems like that has prevented them from getting to strategy, because if all you think you have to do is the tactic, as you point out, of de-escalating, it just buys you that little bit of time. And it's sort of it's kind of like cash flow in a business. It covers a multitude of problems underneath that. A de-escalation, you can say, oh, we're fine, we're good. And then you don't actually solve it, as you pointed out.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that we don't really have the best China strategy. I mean, they actually do have a China strategy, an approach to China that you can argue you know, could amount to a strategy. Again, the word strategy, people define it in different ways. I'm the first to admit that, you know. Some people will say de-escalation and containment are strategies. I disagree. But you know, when it comes to China right now, one thing they've just been trying to do the last year and a half, 2 years, has just been easing the tension with China to the point where we can just have conversations with them. I mean, there was a long time where, you know, our top guys couldn't even get the top Chinese officials to talk to them. So sometimes you do have to take certain steps to just lower the temperature. But there's also the problem that if you don't address the root issue and you just deal with the symptoms, ultimately, it's not going to work, right? And frankly, the Palestinian issue is an example, right? For a long time, the U.S., but also Israel in particular, they just were like, you know what, we can just manage this. We can just manage the Palestinian issue. We'll occasionally have a face-off with Hamas. We'll, you know, do some raids here and there, and it'll just be under control, right? But they didn't try to resolve it. The political crisis with them, the security, there's so many issues that, you know, that many people believe will ultimately can be solved in a Palestinian state. Some people will disagree with that, but the point is that they didn't try to solve it, and you know, we saw what happened in a way. Like it just didn't go away.
Yeah,
we have well learned.
Which is usually the case when you're just trying to maintain the status quo. It never stays the status quo forever. Things change, and I want to get to one other area that you pointed out in your Politico piece, and that is looking at some of the dynamics moving forward that could impact. Again, if there is a strategy that could impact that, including the fact that the Supreme Leader Khamenei is 85 this week. Actually, I think today is his birthday. Is it the 19th? Yeah, it's his birthday.
Oh, is it? I did not know that.
You learn something new every day, right? So as you look at that, and obviously there will be a change, a transition is coming. So how will that, or how is that likely to impact what is happening, and then how the U.S. will either continue to try to manage or come up with a strategy for?
You know, correct. I mean, they need to be thinking about that. Any Iran strategy needs to factor in succession. It's not clear who's going to succeed Khamenei at this stage. It's not clear when. And, you know, one of the challenges for any government, whether democracy, but especially dictatorships that are loathed by their people, is that a transition is almost always a moment of vulnerability, right? It is where things can happen, where things can fall apart. And so it's a question of how you deal with that, whether you have the systems in place to react to that. It's important to remember one thing, though, which is Iran, it's not just a dictatorship of one man. It really is a system. It's almost like, you know, like a spider web, right? And it does have the ability to regenerate itself. Whether it's, you know, even if you kill like the top IRGC commander, they just promote another guy,
right,
you know?
Right.
So it's a little bit more tricky than say a place, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, right? Where it really kind of was all about him.
And
everything kind of fell apart when he fell. So it's going to be tricky. Perhaps there's some brilliant minds out there coming up with a strategy. Notice that I did not offer my own strategy because I'm not that smart, right? But I do hope people will read my column.
Everybody needs to read your column because it's both great writing and it's great insight, as always. Nahal, thank you so much for joining us today. Nahal Tusi, Politico's senior foreign affairs correspondent. And we will have you come back with the strategy next time, Nahal. Thanks so much for joining us. Okay, game on. Game is on. All right.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to step aside for some bottom of the hour news. More inside sources coming up next. Nahal Tusi from Politico. That's why we do this show. She is wicked smart. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We've often talked about the arsonist who's a firefighter, and sometimes that's how things tend to go when it gets to our nation's capital. And sometimes a big federal government tries to solve a government problem with more government problems. Someone who's taken a close look at that and a very interesting, very specific application to all of that. Mark Hyden, of course, is the director of state government affairs at the R Street Institute. Great piece on what President Biden is proposing to fix in government with more government. And Mark, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So let's get into this in terms of how do we actually get out of the arsonist firefighter downward spiral when it comes to government, trying to solve government with more government?
I mean, well, first of all, government is the only sector that can cause a crisis and then claim that the only way to fix that crisis is to give them more power and more money. And that's exactly what's happening here. The government has undermined the housing market, and now the feds supposedly want to fix it by creating new government programs and spending more money, as if a country in $34 trillion in debt has any extra money to spend.
Yeah. And so kind of dig into that, unpack it for us just a little bit in terms of what government programs or processes have been put in place when it comes to the housing and how that impact is rolling out.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you take a step back and you look at it, I mean, I'm sure all of your listeners know prices for houses, it's gone through the roof, but we also don't have inventory at the same time. And a lot of this goes into the fact that in order to try to fight against inflation, the feds have increased the Federal Reserve rate. And what happens when you do that? Mortgage rates go skyrocketing. Right now, they're sitting at over 7%. But it gets compounded even worse when you look at government regulation actually accounts for about 25% of a home's price. So if you buy a $400,000 home, if you take out the government regulation, it would have cost only $300,000. So I think we can all collectively thank the government for that one.
Wow, that is I just want to slow down on that one just a little bit to sit, let that sink in. So if you've recently purchased a new home, or just think of when you bought the home that you're currently living in, that 25% of the cost of that was directly related to regulation. Am I reading that right?
That's correct. I mean, there's various kinds of regulation at different levels of government that will impact this. But all told, a study that came out in 2021 came to that conclusion. And that is just absolutely shocking. Imagine how much more of a house someone could buy or what kind of home someone could buy who is living below the poverty line or struggling if it was 25% cheaper and we just got government out of the way.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about what the president is proposing, again, trying to solve this problem that clearly has a government genesis component to it. Give us a sense of what it is the president's proposing and what the impact of that might be.
Well, I would call it a virtual cash giveaway. That's what he's endorsing.
What could possibly go wrong there?
Correct. But, you know, first of all, like I will commend the Biden administration for acknowledging that there is a housing problem. I mean, we have a shortage of upwards of over 6 million homes that we need to try to bring some balance to the market. But instead of addressing the issues that are laying right in front of us, the Biden administration has gone in a different direction. And they endorsed a plan to add 2 million homes to the market by providing tax incentives to build more houses, offering a $10,000 tax credit to individuals to sell their home, and $25,000 in down payment assistance to first-generation home buyers. Second-generation home buyers need not apply because it wouldn't go to them. So this is just a tax scheme in many ways and a cash giveaway that isn't going to fix it. So, I mean, first of all, his goal is to add 2 million homes to the market. Well, that doesn't do a whole lot when we need over 6 million homes in the market. And a $10,000 tax credit to incentivize someone to sell their home is patently ridiculous, because if they have to buy another home, when you factor in the inflated mortgage rate, they're going to pay $10,000 or more dollars in about a year just in the increased mortgage rates.
Yeah, I think that when I read that in your piece the first time, I think I read it like four times, that there would be $10,000 tax inducement to sell your home. That was a new one for me. And then, of course, you start extrapolating that out, and it's like that just doesn't make sense in any way, shape, or form. And so if you look at some real solutions in terms of what's a better way to go at this in terms of dealing, as you said, 6 million homes short, we're a long, long, long way from that. Even the president's proposal only projects about 2 million. How do we actually get on a path where that becomes a little more plausible?
I mean, it's not going to happen overnight, no matter what we do. But I feel like government is not the answer here. Government is actually the problem to a lot of the issues that we're facing. But we, state, local, and feds, they can all work together to try to ameliorate the situation. One, by cutting some of these regulations that makes it so difficult to build homes and makes it difficult to build affordable homes. So getting rid of some of those costly regulations and working with local officials, because there's different localities that are imposing moratoriums preventing construction of various kinds of housing, which that's not really helping the situation at all. And then lastly, what I think is one of the most important issues to the housing discussion is the Federal Reserve rate, because when Biden took office, or just before he did, the mortgage rates were below 3% for someone with good credit who wanted to buy a home, and now they stand at over 7%. And that is directly related to the Federal Reserve rate. So working to draw that back in a way that can lower mortgage rates will really help the market.
Yeah. Great insight, great perspective. As always, Mark Hyden is the Director of State Government Affairs at the R Street Institute. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, that's Mark Hyden from the R Street Institute. And this is, again, one of those things where on the surface you can say, wow, we're going to have incentives, we're going to have tax inducements. I could never quite wrap my head around, why are we giving a $10,000 tax inducement to someone to sell their home, knowing they're going to have to go buy something else in the process, but not really getting at the root cause. Obviously, where the interest rate is a huge factor in all of that. And then also making sure we're keeping the costs for home builders, those regulatory costs, under control is a big piece of that puzzle as well. And so it's one of those where it sounds good on the surface, but as always, we have to get past the headlines. We have to get underneath it to really make sure we understand what the issue is, what's being promised, what's likely to be the result. To me, this doesn't do anything to deal with regulatory costs, which will keep the cost of homes continuing to go high. And if the interest rates continue to stay high, that means the buying power of the homeowner is less. And that makes it all more difficult. And then, of course, the inventory issue gets compounded by all of that. And so we have to be careful when the government is being both the arsonist and the firefighter. And that's where we often end up with these kinds of things, particularly in an election year. It gets complicated. It gets messy. And that's why getting government out of the way, government has a role to play for sure. But the heavy hand, the over-regulatory stuff, the high interest, those are all things where if we could get government a little more out of the way, we'd get a better result for the American people. All right, we're going to step aside for a quick break. When we come back, more Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And of course, as we continue to march our way towards conventions coming up, not this Saturday, but the next, followed by primary season, we're trying to keep tabs on all the candidates and all the races to see what's happening around the Beehive State. And of course, the Congressional District, open seat with John Curtis choosing to run for a Senate seat instead. One of those who has their eye on that particular seat in Congress, Case Lawrence, is running. He's a resident of Utah County. He's the founder and former CEO of Circus Tricks, now Sky Zone. And Case, welcome to the show.
Boyd, thanks for having me.
As you begin this journey, I have to give you the counsel that I've given everyone as they think about running for Congress, and that is the most frustrated people in our nation's capital are those who are entrepreneurs or former business executives. They tend to be part of what I call the flat forehead society. You slap your head thinking, I don't understand that. So I want to know, Case, what is it that got you into this race, knowing that government is not going to run nearly as well as you've run your business?
Yeah. Look, I feel a sense of urgency about the direction of our country, just like you and I know many of your listeners. And I've watched over the last congressional term here as we have gotten nothing done. And frankly, that, you know, that's not just a problem of the entire House. It's a problem of our Republican caucus. we have got to be smarter team players back there. And instead, we've been sowing drama. We've been infighting. We've been trying to excommunicate our speaker rather than get things done. So to your point, Boyd, that's one of the big motivators for me getting into this race. We need to send serious people back to Washington, D.C., and I will be that kind of leader, that kind of representative for the 3rd District.
Yeah, we always say that the real driver of freedom, not just here in the U.S., but around the world, are the entrepreneurs and the business owners. And if you want to help a country that's in socialism or in some kind of dictatorship, it's getting those institutions that support entrepreneurs and business owners. Give me a sense in terms of how you would approach some of those crucial issues back in D.C. through the lens of your entrepreneurial and business experience.
Yeah, you know, to that point, I'm the only person in this race who has a track record of doing big things in the real world of business. I built a billion-dollar business with over 5,000 employees. And through that, through leading and building that, Boyd, I found myself on the front lines of just about every major economic crisis of our generation, both the Great Recession and then most recently in COVID. We have trampoline parks and kids' playgrounds all over the world. And during COVID, over 300 of them were shut down for an average of over 7.5 months. And we had to dig in. We had to negotiate with landlords, with employees, with banks. And we did. We were able to do that and get things done. So you're right. I do have a bias toward getting real things done. And I'm hoping that that will give me credibility and leadership in our own caucus to help be a force for doing that.
Yeah. As you look at and project forward, if we got to January 5th of 2025 and things came out right, what would be the highest priority? Day one, you're sworn in. What's next?
You know, there's a lot of big problems. For me, the number one urgent problem is the border. And it's urgent because there is this time element, Boyd, where every day thousands of people are pouring over and presenting themselves at the border. And so every day counts. And for that reason, for that time urgency, I think the border is the number one issue. And I am very optimistic. I'm optimistic that we can win the White House, that we can flip the Senate. And if we do, we are going to pass historic legislation substantially in the form of H.R. 2, which is there and waiting in the wings. And I think we can make, that's one area we can make a big impact. I'm optimistic.
As you've been out on the campaign trail talking to the voters in the 3rd Congressional District, what have you been hearing, and especially what has surprised you as you've gone through this process thus far?
Well, you know, I've been surprised by a number of things, but the biggest thing I've been surprised at is how well-informed Utah voters are, and specifically how well-informed delegates are in this state who are participating in that process. And the questions they bring are deep, they are detailed, and they are well informed. So that's one big surprise. You know, I've also been surprised at how much difference of opinion there is in the current Republican Party. There's a lot of different thoughts, different opinions seem to be, you know, even though we agree on maybe 90% of things, there's some vociferous disagreements on certain issues. And like many, I'm hopeful we can remember that we're all on the same team as we discuss those rationally and find a way forward as a party.
All right. And then final question for you, and this is a question I ask to every candidate, any office from city mayor to president of the United States. I've asked everybody the same question. And it is, as you're learning, campaigns are hard. They're brutal. They can be awful, painful, exhausting, exasperating. All of those things, plus to your family. What is it that would make all of this worthwhile? Even if you got to the first Tuesday in November and you came up short, what would still have made it all worthwhile?
Well, I already feel that it's all been worthwhile. My family is aligned in this journey with me. They've been actively involved in this campaign, and it's actually been one of the great adventures we've shared as a family, one of the great experiences. So already, I feel that, and Boyd, I feel like my eyes have been open. I've learned so much. I've met so many people, and you know, become so much from this experience that it's hard to I don't think I'll ever regret it, regardless of the outcome. But I'm just, it's made me more grateful to be a member of the great state of Utah and of the Republican Party. It really, really has. It's brought me back to a basic appreciation for those things and for our country.
Fantastic. Case Lawrence running for the 3rd congressional seat, resident of Utah County. And Case, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck over these last week and a half to get to convention and beyond. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you as the campaign rolls forward. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Boyd.
All right, again, that's Case Lawrence running in the 3rd Congressional District, and always fascinating to see what draws people in. I loved his perspective in terms of what he's learning in the process, the confidence it gives in the state of the state of Utah, and the direction that we can actually move forward together with. So great perspective there. Big thanks to Case Lawrence for joining us as he runs for that 3rd congressional seat. We'll continue to cycle candidates through as we have this conversation. And I love that Case Lawrence pointed out how educated the voters are that are coming to these town halls and to these campaign events. And I do think it is a unique thing here in the state of Utah that people are engaged, that they are leaning in. And I hope you're leaning in as you get to know candidates in a wide range of races, from the federal level right down to the city and the local level. Those are all crucial conversations to be had. It's your job to be part of it, to be informed, so that you can actually make your vote matter, not just count. All right, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news. Hour number two coming up next. Stick around. We'll be right back.
FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
President Joe Biden has been on the campaign trail this week in the important battleground state of Pennsylvania, and the president continues to make a play for steel union votes, made some announcements this week. We want to dig into what those are, what they might do, the downstream consequences, and what they actually might mean in terms of some votes come the first Tuesday of November. To help us break all of that down, Eric Boehm, of course, from Reason. And Eric, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Boyd, glad to be here.
All right. So a couple of days ago, the Biden administration launched a new line of attacks on the former president and made some new promises in terms of things relating to steel. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's right. A bit of contradiction here from the Biden administration and the Biden campaign. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen the Biden campaign start to ramp up this line of attack on, you know, basically trying to turn around the inflation issue on Trump and say, you know, well, okay, maybe you voters are concerned about inflation. Maybe the last years haven't been so bad. But look at what former President Donald Trump wants to do. If he gets elected in November, he's going to put more tariffs on things. He's proposed, like, this is a fair attack. I mean, Trump has proposed a 10% tariff on everything that comes into the country. He's also floated the idea of 60% tariffs on goods from China. That will undeniably raise prices for consumers and for businesses. And that's, you know, that's something that would certainly add to inflation. And so the Biden campaign has tried to turn this, you know, around on Trump, basically, and say, look, if you think inflation was bad while Joe Biden was in charge, well, just wait until Donald Trump gets back to the White House. And which is all fine and good. I think, you know, as political attacks go, I think it's actually probably a pretty reasonable one. But then you've got the president yesterday during what was nominally an official White House event, but realistically was just a campaign event in Pittsburgh, is standing up in front of a bunch of unionized steelworkers and promising that he's going to put new higher tariffs on steel from China. So, you know, at this point, I don't know. I guess it's just a competition over who can slap more tariffs on the right bad guys. I guess that's what we're doing now. We're just singling out
political opponents on the international stage that we think deserve to be tariffed. And of course, tariffs are just taxes on consumers. So all of this guaranteed to backfire on Americans.
Yeah, on Americans. It may be helpful for a campaign moment. Might do some wonders for their fundraising. May lock in a few extra votes here and there. But for the American people, it's not going to end well when it comes to prices for goods, for sure. And so I want to break it down just a little bit because you hit a couple of things that I think are important for us to remember about a campaign. And that is you called it a nominally official gathering. We call it the Rose Garden on the Road strategy, where you do something that is sort of kind of almost within the realm of your governing duties, and then you make the rest of it feel very much like a campaign event. So clearly the Rose Garden on the Road is going to be a major strategy for President Biden. But now unpack for us both that strategy and then how all of this will actually impact the American people if this kind of tariff that, again, the president's clearly playing to the steel union votes. How's that all going to play out?
Yeah, right. I mean, obviously, that's what he's doing here, right? To take your last point first, he's obviously just playing to the steel union votes. He wants the applause from the blue-collar steel workers in a swing state like Pennsylvania, in a swing state like Ohio. You know, maybe that's enough to swing the election. Obviously, that's why these types of events are happening. But this is an official policy. There is official government weight behind this. The Commerce Department is now looking into, they've begun the process of investigating whether more tariffs on China would be appropriate. That's a lengthy process, may actually take us beyond the election before anything actually happens. As I said, the piece that I wrote for Reason, I think the best thing that can be said about this proposal from Biden is that it would be ineffective because we actually don't import much steel from China anymore. We want 20 years ago, but we just don't anymore. It is somewhere between the seventh and ninth, kind of it bounces up and down, but somewhere between the seventh and ninth largest source of steel the last few years to the United States. It is way behind. Accounts for about 2% of overall steel imports. Last year, it did about 2% of overall steel imports. It's miles behind places like Germany and Canada and Mexico, which are our biggest suppliers. And so ultimately, slap some more tariffs on Chinese steel, whatever. You could cut Chinese steel completely out of the market and it wouldn't make much of a difference. So on one hand, he's acting like this is a policy that's going to have significant, serious, because this is, you know, real protectionism that's going to save American steelworking jobs. I mean, it's not. And if it did, if it was serious enough to actually shift the market, then it would cause price increases downstream that would be bad for consumers who are upset about inflation. So I don't know. This is just completely nonsensical to me. But about the only good thing that I can say about it is that it kind of won't matter.
Yeah. And I think that's so important for us to recognize. Again, the headlines are the headlines. And everyone can say, oh, wow, these big tariffs on Chinese steel. Playing tough, playing hardball with the Chinese, all of those kinds of things. America first, both sides of the aisle will, you know, dance on those kind of bumper stickers. And yet, as you said, at best, it's going to be a non-factor because we really don't use that much Chinese steel anymore. But the precedent in terms of the philosophy behind it is the one that we really should be taking a look at.
Yeah, I mean, it's concerning to me as somebody who recognizes the benefits of free trade that it's really concerning to me that you now have two major party presidential candidates. You've had, you know, now at this point, two consecutive presidents and presidential administrations that have been pretty openly hostile to free trade. Trump obviously put a bunch of tariffs in place, raised the overall tariff rates that had fallen for decades until he got into office. And now, you know, overall average U.S. tariff rates went up during his tenure. Biden has kept most of those in place. He's loosened a few of them in small ways, but the big ones are still there. And now Biden, of course, is talking about adding more. So you do have, you know, kind of a locking in that occurs with any policy when you have, you know, one president come in and make a bunch of policy changes and the next administration of a different party doesn't roll those things back. You know, you can look at anything from, like, you know, the Patriot Act implemented under George W. Bush, and then, you know, a lot of that maintained and expanded by Barack Obama, and now you have a national security apparatus that is basically impossible to dislocate. And it's the same sort of thing on trade policy. Once you have multiple administrations backing similar and similarly bad policies, then it becomes really difficult to get that out of the public policy mainstream here in D.C.
Yeah, no question about that. And it is the big threat and the big danger, I think, when you play the populist politics card. And as you said, we've seen it on the Democrats and the Republicans, and that makes it the precedent, and that becomes the governing philosophy. And as you pointed out, that if this kind of policy continues to go, the biggest impact, the hardest hit, are going to be American citizens and consumers who are going to pay more for those goods and services. And that, to me, is the thing that goes way beyond the bumper sticker. Eric Boehm, reporter at Reason, great piece at Reason.com. Check that out today, because it'll help you see beyond the headlines of what everybody's touting in terms of this America First and tariffs and protectionism, because it really isn't quite what it means or what it seems to mean in the headlines. Underneath it, there's some really bad policy that ultimately hurts American consumers. Eric, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Boyd.
All right, we'll step aside for one last break. Some final thoughts on Inside Sources coming up next.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today, as it always is. I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, I want to go back to the beginning. You've heard me say it on the show a lot. Leadership is what leadership does. And we've had a lack of leadership in so many places, especially in government, especially at the federal level, that it's always interesting when we actually hear something that sounds like leadership or acts like leadership. And we always like to point that out. And over the last 24 hours, we have heard from both the Speaker of the House and the Democratic Minority Leader, and it actually sounded like leadership. And so I don't care where your politics are. I don't care how you feel about aid to Israel or to aid going into Gaza for humanitarian or Ukraine or Taiwan. Just what they're dealing with back there and what the two leaders in the House, the Democrat and the Republican, had to say in terms of what we should be thinking about and how we should be approaching the job. I think it's worth going back and just thinking about this because, again, it sounds like what I think leadership is supposed to sound like. And so let's start yesterday. The Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, he had unveiled his plan for the foreign aid bills, chopped them up into pieces. So one for Israel, one for Ukraine, one for Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific, and then one for aid, particularly aid going into Gaza. And as he did that, of course, he was asked about those within his own party who want to oust him if he brings these bills to the floor. Here's how he responded.
My philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel. I believe Xi and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live fire exercise for me, as it is so many American families. And I'm going to allow an opportunity for every single member of the House to vote their conscience and their will on this. And I think that's the way this institution is supposed to work. And I'm willing to take personal risk for that, because we have to do the right thing and history will judge us.
Have to do the right thing. History will judge us. I think there were some extraordinary points in there. Now, listen to the House Minority Leader, the Democrat leader, Hakeem Jeffries, who talked about the path forward, also with some things that sound like leadership.
Our top line commitment is ironclad. We are going to make sure that we stand by our democratic allies in Ukraine, in Israel, in the Indo-Pacific, and make sure that we secure the humanitarian assistance necessary to surge into Gaza and other theaters of war throughout the globe.
Now, if you take those two statements, and these are two people, they're at the top of the food chain when it comes to the House of Representatives, the Speaker and the Minority Leader, that they have the ultimate power there when it comes to shaping and driving an agenda. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson said, I'm bringing these things to the floor and history will judge us. And if that costs me my job, so be it. That's what a leader is supposed to sound like. It's doing the right thing, what you think is the best thing. Doesn't mean everybody's going to agree with you. And if you lose your job doing the right thing, that's still a pretty good day. And I think our nation depends on that. And so, again, regardless how you feel about the policy, we need to have this kind of leadership on everything that's going on in the House, in the Senate. Everything that's happening in the Oval Office needs to be looked at through that lens of we're going to do the right thing. We're not going to just play the political games. We're not just going to game everything out to see if we can pick up more seats in November and have the majority and all of those things or win the White House back, whatever it may be. That's not the game. Because the job is not a game. The job is a job. And members of Congress signed up to do a job, not play a political game. And sadly, we've been seeing far more political games than we have people doing the job they were elected to do. And I think the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries, said, look, we are going to stand with an ironclad commitment to our allies, to Israel, to Ukraine, to Taiwan, and those in the Indo-Pacific. We're going to make sure we get aid in to those suffering in Gaza, innocent civilians that are caught up in all of this. It's an and conversation. It's not a fake fight and a false choice. And so I commend Hakeem Jeffries on that. And so we've become far too comfortable in this country with just the political battles and the political games, as opposed to statesmanship, stateswomanship, real leaders stepping up, speaking out, even standing alone if necessary, even saying, you want to take away my job? Go ahead. History will judge us for what we do and whether we stand by. I also thought it was very interesting that the Speaker of the House said, I believe Vladimir Putin, that he's not going to stop in Ukraine, that he will go on to Poland or to the Balkans or to other areas in Europe, that he's not done, that Xi is being honest and transparent when he says that Taiwan will be reabsorbed into the motherland. I think there are a lot of things we need to look at in terms of Iran and North Korea, for that matter. And so you put all of those together, we better act. We better do something. As we talked about earlier in the show, we have had far too many people just hoping things will de-escalate, hoping things will change, hoping thugs and bad guys and dictators won't do what thugs and bad guys and dictators always do. And while hope is important in all of this, hope is not a strategy. And we have to have a strategy. And part of the strategy is to do the job, to put bills on the floor, to have open debate, to have a real amendment process, to make it better, do it in front of the American people, take a vote, as Speaker Johnson said, so that every member can represent their constituents and vote their conscience in terms of what they think is best for their constituents and best for the country. And then the people of the country can decide whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. That's how accountability actually works. So some nice leadership from both the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of teeing up the conversation. We're going to watch to see how the action part of it plays out rolling into the weekend. That wraps it up for us here on Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. I'm Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us today. And as always, as you go out into the world, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.